hear our speaker, especially since this was a week where we had a speaker on Tuesday night. And such is the richness of the Vancouver Institute, now in its 89th year this month, that we bring you the brother of the Dalai Lama on personal transformation one night, and the glories of ancient Athens 5 days later. I didn't even ask him to do that. We have a great deal of classical material coming, in fact, and as program coordinator for both the Canadian Hellenic Cultural Society and the Archaeological Institute of America Vancouver Society, I've left some announcements of upcoming lectures in archaeology, not just Greek. We actually have an archaeologist on Roman Scotland coming in 3 weeks to talk to us here at the Institute as well. Just because I'm an archaeologist doesn't mean we always have archaeological speakers, but somehow this term it worked out that way. And there is a classical talk on the board, if any of you are interested as well. There will be coffee and refreshments outside in the lobby after the lecture is over, and you're all invited to stay and meet the speaker and talk with her and with each other. We do this every few weeks to give people a chance to get together. I know many of you are regulars here. I see familiar faces, the 15 years that I've been on and off president of the Institute, and it's always a delight to see the old familiar faces, but one of the great pleasures is that every week there are new faces as well, and we hope some of those new faces will become old faces with time. It's an especial pleasure, however, to welcome Professor Susan Rotroff here tonight. She and I were students together in Athens in 1968-69 at the American School of Classical Studies. We were both graduate students. And we have our paths have crossed numerous times since then. She's helped with our pottery at Mytilene and at our other site at Stymphalus. Her own work has made her one of the most distinguished archaeologists in North America, in the Greek world. She is one of the world's leading authorities on Greek pottery of the Hellenistic period, has published a number of enormous books on pottery from the Athenian Agora in Athens. She'll talk about some of that tonight, as well as pottery from Sardis in Asia Minor. She has received a prestigious Humboldt Fellowship to work in Germany, an even more prestigious MacArthur Foundation Fellowship to work in North America. Her undergraduate training was at Bryn Mawr. Her graduate degrees are from Princeton University. However, her first teaching was in Canada at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick, where she spent a number of years before going on to Hunter College in New York, and now at Washington University, where she holds a named chair in St. Louis. She has lectured around the world. We were sort of counting continents as we were driving over, and she has lectured on 5 continents, still has to manage South America and Antarctica. The last one may be quite a challenge, but it's a great pleasure to have her with us tonight on her first visit to Vancouver, fog and all, and to talk to us about one particular aspect of her work. We called it New Light on an Old Agora, but in fact it's about 450 baby burials and 150 dogs, kids and dogs. Professor Susan Rotroff.
Thank you very much, Hector. Can you all hear me? This is working as it should. Good. Okay, now we'll do the technical stuff. I think that's good. What you see here on the slide is a view that actually I think it includes the building in which Hector and I met when we were students. Off the very left is the American School of Classical Studies, where we were studying as graduate students in the 1960s. Of course, you're looking at a view over modern Athens. And modern Athens, of course, is a huge city, but it has underneath it another city, some years ago to build a new subway system, the Athens Metro, in anticipation of the Olympics, the Greeks began a massive excavation and tremendous archaeological work, which resulted in an exhibit that was called The City Beneath the City, and is now partially displayed in the subway stations of Athens so that modern Athenians rushing to the future can look at their past. And what I'm going to be talking to you about today is some of the things that have been found under this huge modern metropolis. And of course, it is a challenge digging underneath a modern city, but that is what we have been involved in excavations that started in 1931 in Athens. Now, most people are familiar with the Acropolis that you see on the upper right up there. It's an icon of modern Athens. There is legislation that prevents building buildings that are higher than the Acropolis. So it's become an important symbol of the city. And it was, of course, a symbol in antiquity as well, and it was at first a citadel and then a sacred center of the city. But almost all ancient cities had two kinds of centers. They had a sacred center, but they also had a more secular center, the agora, the great open public square, that was set aside for political and commercial activity. And in the foreground, you are seeing the agora as it appears today after over 70 years of excavations that have revealed the buildings that were built there in ancient times. This is taken in the early years of the excavations. Excavations began, as I said, in 1931. The plan at the time was to dig for 10 years. Excavations are still going on. Archaeologists have a way of doing this. And a bunch of students are planning with great excitement to come this summer and to participate. But the plan was for 10 years. This was financed by John D. Rockefeller, although originally as an anonymous donor, because he was afraid property values were going to go up a lot if the Rockefeller name were heard. But he eventually was revealed as the benefactor who did the original funding. And there were very clear-cut goals. First of all, they wanted to confirm that this was the ancient civic center of Athens. A lot was known about it from ancient literary sources, but no one knew precisely where it was. So the first goal was to find the agora. Second goal was to define its limits. Where did it stop? How large was it? And that is actually a goal that has still not been realized. The northern limits are still under modern buildings that are actually being demolished right now as we search for those northern limits. At the present time, the excavation has proceeded to the large buildings you see in the distance in that photograph. Those buildings were taken down at the beginning of the 1980s, and excavation has proceeded a bit further to the north. So find the agora, define its limits, and then investigate its public buildings. And since this was the public center of the first European democracy, founded by the Athenians in 508 BC, it has more than ordinary interest to those of us in the modern world who live under democratic political systems. So that was the goal. And they fairly quickly realized that goal. Now, in the picture you just saw, there were some ruins that had been uncovered, but it's extraordinarily difficult to know what these ruins are unless you have some hints. And after they had been digging for some years, they unearthed this stone, which was embedded in the earth. It was still in situ, and it has an inscription on it that runs from the upper right corner, runs from right to left. Early Greek inscriptions go either way, depending on, I guess, the mood of the stonecutter on any one day. And this reads from right to left and down the side of the stone, and it says, "I am the boundary of the agora." So that was pretty nice. And I'm sure that the first director of the excavations, Leslie Scheer Sr., breathed a huge sigh of relief because, after all, he had his donor who was paying money every year and wanted results, and he could say, yes, we know that we have found the agora and we are digging in the right place. So that having been confirmed, the goal was to define the limits and then to reconstruct the history of this area through the centuries. And that too was achieved, and it made it possible, for instance, to make plans and models of the Civic Center as it existed at various different times. And here you see a model of the Civic Center as it existed in the 2nd century BC. And on the right-hand side, a long building bordering it. In the distance, another long colonnaded building that bordered it. The one on the right was probably a commercial building. The problem is that this slide is backwards. That's why it looks so funny, but that's okay. Don't worry about that. Anyway, over on the left, you see a little hill that has a building on it, that has a little temple on it. And that was a hill known as the Hill of the Agora. And it's in that area that we're going to be looking for these babies and dogs that Hector has already mentioned to you. So keep that in mind. Keep the temple and the little hill in mind, because it's at the same period, the 2nd century, that I'm going to be talking about. I have a plan. Ah, good. That's right way around. That also shows this area at exactly that same time. And you see on the right-hand side the long, narrow building, another long pair of long, narrow buildings to the south. Along the left-hand side, a series of buildings, but a conspicuously empty area in the center. And the agora basically is an empty area that's left free from structures. So the buildings that they found that limited the area were all the way around the sides of this area. But that area was marked off as for public use only. No private structures could be built there. And clearly there was concern about this. That was the reason for putting up the boundary stones. Now, if you look at the left, you can see a building in the second large square down on the left-hand side that's labeled Hephaestion. That's the little temple that you saw in the model. It's a temple that was dedicated to the gods Athena and Hephaestus in the middle of the 5th century. And to the north of it, on that hill, is the place where this well was located. Because that temple is actually outside of the agora area itself, and you'll notice as you look around the large and impressive buildings that there are lots of other much smaller and less impressive buildings, and these are primarily private houses, workshops, and places where the ordinary people of Athens lived. Now, the agora archaeologists didn't have too much interest in the ordinary people of ancient Athens. They wanted to know about the actions of Pericles and the impressive figures of history, and they wanted to know about the large public buildings. But archaeologists don't often have a choice about what they're going to study, because although they intend to find one thing, they often find a different thing or other things in addition to what they were looking for. And so in addition to all these public buildings that were investigated, the archaeologists also investigated many private houses and the wells and cisterns that had served as water sources for those private houses. And here you see a view, we're down in the agora, and you see foundations of buildings in the foreground, and these are foundations of public buildings. In the distance, you see the temple. That's the temple we've been looking at, a temple of Hephaestus, a very, very well-preserved building that was converted to a church in the 4th century, which has preserved it in very good condition. And it's just to the north, that is further to the right of that building, that the well where these mysterious bones were found is located. So that well is located outside of a public space, in a private space, but not too far away from the public space. And it's also located near a temple, but not in a temple precinct, and in a private area. It's a little easier to envision all of this perhaps from a model. This is a model that actually shows the agora in the Roman period, but it has a view of this same hill, the agora hill, on which is located the temple, which has a nice little grove built around it, as you can see. And if you look at the hillside on this side of the temple, you see a very large building with hardly any windows. That was the arsenal of Athens, and it blocked off the northern part of that hill from the temple. You'll see at the very bottom of the hill, there is a thoroughfare, a little road, and there was a little shrine down there. You'll also see a staircase going up to a temple. That was the invention of an archaeologist, and it never existed, we've now discovered. So you have to think away that temple and that staircase. So the hillside itself was really fairly inaccessible. It was blocked off by the arsenal. It was blocked off by the back of the public buildings at the agora. And there was a steep hill slope going down to the roadway below. Now, on that hillside, and not shown on the model, because model makers, like the early archaeologists, weren't too interested in domestic architecture and houses, there were remains of houses. Greek houses are built usually of mud brick, and they don't leave too much in the way of traces, so they're hard to reconstruct, and they don't lend themselves to the building of impressive models, but there were traces of houses on that hillside. The occasion of my coming to Vancouver at this time was not only to deliver this lecture, but to deliver another lecture in honor of the woman who excavated that area, Dorothy Thompson, whom you see in this photograph taken in 1933. She's at the right-hand end of the front row in the very fetching hat. Behind her stands Homer Thompson, whom she would marry 1 year in the future from this picture, and he would go on to be the director, the second director of the excavations, and also to be the head of the School of Historical Studies at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, and he was also a distinguished graduate of the University of British Columbia. Dorothy was the first woman to be chosen as a fellow of the Agora excavations, an honor that was bestowed on only the most promising of graduate students at that time. And Homer, her husband, was also an Agora fellow and assistant to the director. And she is the person who was assigned the excavation of this hilltop in 1937 and 1938, 3 and 4 summers after this photograph was taken. And you can see here a photograph of what she found. This is actually pretty good preservation for an Athenian house of the 2nd century BC. She excavated there for 2 summers, and at the lower right-hand corner of this slide, you can see a kind of teepee-shaped structure that's been built up. And this was the crane that was built over the well in which the bones I'm going to be talking about were found. And it was built so that buckets of finds could be brought up from down in the well. The well was located just to the north of and must have served a small house. And you can see the walls of that house as well as a plastered floor, even though there are a lot of later cuttings that are cut into the house. Further off in the distance, if you could look further up the hill, one would see the temple of Hephaestus in the distance. Now, if we reconstruct what this area looked like, there were a lot of wells and cisterns in the area, which have been indicated by dots. And the ones that are of about the same date as the well we're going to look at are pink dots. You can see the Temple of Hephaestus at the lower left. Then you have the arsenal, which has been incorrectly restored with a colonnade, so you have to forget about that colonnade. Archaeological architects experiment a lot with what should be done with the bare bones of the foundations that they find. So this was an experiment. Maybe it was a colonnaded building, but we think it wasn't. And you can see the dot marked G53. That's the well in which the bones were found, and which from now on I will refer to as the bone well, which in fact has become its official name at the excavations. So you can see where it's located, the agora area to the right. But it was, you have to then populate that area with little houses that were in fact at this time definitely in a state of disrepair. And all of those water sources that are marked were being filled in with junk. They were being filled in with garbage so that they were no longer useful for drawing water. And the bone well, you see here, was a very deep well. It was at least 21 meters deep. It was never dug all the way to the bottom because it was unsafe. The bedrock of Athens is very soft, and it collapses easily. Wells are usually lined with terracotta tiles to prevent collapse, but sometimes even so, collapse does take place. So they dug as far as they could. They did dig to a point, however, where they weren't finding anything in the soil. So they were probably very near to the bottom of the well. Well, you can see from the drawing here, not very much in the way of cultural material was found in the upper 13 meters of the well. So there was quite a long stretch of the well that when it wasn't receiving any kind of human-generated junk. But then, as they dug deeper, at a depth of 13 meters, they started to come upon bones. Well, you often find bones in a well, but they were finding buckets full, handful of bones. And this bone deposit filled 7 meters of the well. The well itself is about a meter in diameter, from 7 to 20 meters. When they got a bit below 13 meters, they started to find pottery in very large amounts, lots and lots of household debris that had been thrown into the well. And then when they got to the depth of 16 meters, they started to find a lot of bronze. The bronze was in very poor condition. There was almost nothing that could be reconstructed as an object, but all of the objects in contact with these bronze fragments had turned green. And this was a very good thing for the bones, because the bronze, the heavy metals in the bronze, actually served as a preservative, and that's why the bones had survived in the very good condition that they're in. Now, the first thing that archaeologists think about when they find something is the date. What is the date? So I'm going to get a little bit ahead of my story of the interpretation of this well to tell you about the date and what we can now say about the date. We can date it primarily from the material culture, from the man-made objects that it contains, and the most datable of objects at this time, you might think it would be coins that would be the most useful. But the Greeks did not stamp their coins with year-by-year dates. Furthermore, when the Greeks lost a silver coin, they looked and looked until they found it again, because silver coinage was a fairly large amount of money. So the kinds of things that are lost in these wells are bronze coinage, very badly corroded, very hard to identify at all, and it can't be dated very closely. So instead of coins, it's objects like this. These are transport amphoras. They are the barrels of antiquity. Wood was in very short supply in the Greek world, and so for transportation of foodstuffs, particularly wine and oil, but also other foods, they used clay containers like this, with pointed toes. They were well designed to be packed into ships and to lean against the side of the hold of the ship and to be shipped from place to place. These amphoras can be identified as products of the Greek city of Knidos, which is located on the coast of Turkey, by the distinctive toes and by the fabric that they're made of. The other thing about such amphoras is since they were commercial containers, they were stamped by officials of the cities that produced them by officials. And these were officials whose name who changed yearly. And you get stamps on their upper parts of their handles that look something like this. Horrific things. They look as though they couldn't possibly be read. But there are experts who have studied these and can not only read them, but have also established the sequence of names of people who stamped them. And so using this, we can actually date these objects to within a year. The reason I go through all that is there is one of these stamped amphora handles in the well. Actually, there are several. The latest that comes at the top of the deposit was stamped with the name of a man who was called Euphragoras. And Euphragoras was an official in Knidos just a little bit before the year 150 BC. So the top part of this deposit was thrown in a little before 150 or later than that. We can limit the lower level, we can come to a lower limit because very distinctive types of pottery that we know the Athenians made after 150 are missing from the deposit. So this deposit was probably laid down in the years just before 150. We don't know whether it was in the 10 years or the 20 years before 150, but probably not over a longer period than that. So it was an accumulated deposit that gradually built up in the well over maybe a 5-year period, and maybe a 20-year period, but something within that range. Now, the bones, of course, were the most spectacular part of the find, this large number of bones of babies. And Dorothy Thompson took a tremendous interest in those bones, and she tried to interest other people back in 1937. But maybe the world just wasn't ready for all these baby bones, because she never really managed to get anyone to take a serious interest in it. And you have to realize that in those days, there were very, very few physical anthropologists working in Greece. In fact, you could count them on the fingers of one finger. There was one person, and that's him, Dr. Larry Angel, who was a forensic anthropologist. He worked at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He worked with the police in solving crimes. He wrote pamphlets for crime fighters to help them with when they found skeletal material. And he also went to Greece pretty much every year and looked at the skeletal material that had been found by American excavators all over Greece. And on the Agora excavations, we have skeletons, of course, from various different periods, and each skeleton has an angel number, which I think is really very appropriate. But it doesn't have anything to do with where they went after they died. It's just after Dr. Angel's name. Now, Angel took an interest in the bones, and he came and looked at them, but if he was looking at all the bones of all the excavations in Greece, you can see he didn't have too much time to linger. He did write an article about the baby bones in 1945. They were described in, I would say, about a 10-line, one-column-wide description. And he estimated that there were about 175 babies. He quickly counted the scapulae, and that was the number he got out of that. The animal bones that were found with them, the dogs, really received no attention. They were informally studied. There was a report filed at the excavation. but they were never finally, they were never published. In the 1990s, a group of us decided that it was time to get together a modern archaeological team and to realize Dorothy Thompson's dream of really properly studying this material. We had to wait until archaeology in Greece had evolved to the point where there were sufficient experts not only in physical anthropology, but also in zooarchaeology and the study of animal bones, which for Greek excavations is still rather a new thing. And so we put together a new team of three people, a physical anthropologist, a zooarchaeologist, and myself as archaeologist. The bones of the babies, human bones, were to be studied by Lisa Little, whom you see here measuring them. And you may notice she's got a sort of brace on her hand. She actually developed carpal tunnel syndrome in measuring all of these bones. There were so many, and she's a very, very hard worker. And she began getting out all the material, cleaning it, and looking at it again, and photographing it. And this is to give you an idea of how many baby bones we have. They're all sorted here, the left tibia, the left femur, the right femur. And you'll notice also how green they are. It's this copper from the bronze that has preserved them in this very good state of preservation. Lisa's analysis revealed that there were many more individuals than Angel had thought, and she based her estimate on the femora, which are not as easy to sort out quickly as the scapula, because you have to look carefully and see, is it a femur, is it a left, is it a right? So she had the time to do this, which Angel never did, and she came up with a count, a minimum number of individuals of 450. Now, another question we asked, now we know how many, how old were these individuals, and what is the range of age within the individuals? Well, this photograph shows among the bones of infants the range, the largest femur that was found, the smallest femur, and a femur that indicates the average. Almost all of the bones were the average. There was only one that was small, and that would be a five-month fetus. That was a baby that must have been a miscarriage and never came to full term. The longer bone is from a child between the ages of 6 and 18 months, and there were only two in that range. All of the other bones were in that medium range, and judging by comparative studies with modern human material, these were newborn babies. Now, we can't say for certain that they were 1 hour old or 1 day old or even 7 days old, but they were neonates. They were very, very close to absolutely newborn. A more graphic illustration of these same statistics, the maximum, the minimum, and the mean, are shown in these shoulder blades that are being held in Lisa's hand. I should also point out that there was one adult. I don't have any photographs of him. He's quite charming. He has a very, very green skull. And for a long time, his skull was on loan to the School of Medicine at the University of Athens, and it was hard to get it back because they liked it. It was an interesting skull, but Lisa did finally get back the skull and was able to study the adult individual, and there was also one child who was 11 years old. They pose some other problems in addition to the questions we have about the neonates. The dogs were studied by Lynn Snyder, whom you see here. She refuses to have her face photographed. I don't know what the problem is. But anyway, I could at least take this picture, and she's got her dog bones laid out here. Dogs are one of her specialties. And she reported about the animal bones that there's a scattering of what you might call normal garbage, which is food remains, remains from the making of tools of animal bones. There's lots of sheep and goats and horse and a turtle shell. But what was remarkable was the number of dogs. 150 dogs by her count. And the dogs are, as you can see some of their skulls here, they too have been well preserved because of the copper. And you can make out that there were dogs of different breeds. Even if you're not a zooarchaeologist, you can see that these are two quite different animals in the sizes of their skulls and in the shapes of the skulls. So we had a wide variety of different sorts of dogs. And we had dogs of all different ages. The one with the beautiful emerald green tooth is a puppy with brand new teeth that are all nice and sharp. And what you see up above is the abscessed jaw of a very aged dog. So we have very young dogs, we have very old dogs, and we have middle-aged dogs. We have a kind of complete spectrum of dogs, which makes this a rather unusual collection. In normal die-off, what you would expect is a lot of very young and old individuals and not so many middle-aged ones. So apparently from the point of view of zooarchaeology, this is a little bit unusual. These dogs were not pampered pets. They had all kinds of pathologies. They had bones that had been broken and had not healed very well. Lots of times it was the bones of the back legs, as though they got kicked a lot as they ran away from people who didn't want them around. And we know that some of the dogs were male. This is the baculum or the penis bone, which identifies male dogs. And there are some other more subjective estimates that are based on skull morphology that suggested to Lynn that there were probably an equal number of male and female dogs in our collection. So much for the bone, where I'm really reporting the work of other people. This is me working on the pottery. The pottery has been in old olive tins. You can see what those tins look like, horrible rusted things. And it has been collecting dust since the 1930s. The first time I studied it, I got dreadful laryngitis from breathing that dust. And it's now become standard practice for us to wear nuisance masks and also to vacuum the pottery. That's what that tube I'm holding is attached to, a vacuum cleaner. So my part of the project was to look at the material culture, particularly the pottery, and also the historical and cultural context of this find, and to try to set it into to understand it in a broader way. So of course, since my specialty is Hellenistic pottery, this was right up my alley. And the first thing we get from the pottery is the date. I've already mentioned that the deposit was laid down sometime between, in the years before 150, but between from about maybe 170 down to 150, or maybe 160 down to 150. The pottery is fairly uniform. Here you see some of the shapes we have, bowls, plates, jugs. Perfectly ordinary, nothing unusual about it, the same kind of pottery you would find in any garbage dump of the time. And since it's fairly uniform, we can be pretty confident that it did not accumulate over a very long period of time, that the well received these deposits, both of pottery and of bones, over maybe a decade or maybe two decades. It had a good complement of drinking cups and jugs that would have been used for the drinking of wine, very, very common in Greek pottery deposits. But one thing I was interested was whether or not there would be any pottery that I could associate with the babies themselves. And I have a couple of candidates. These are small containers, usually 3 or 4 inches high, of a very coarse sort of clay, and they were used to contain perfumed oil. They show up in domestic deposits, but they are also very, very common funerary gifts. In fact, this is usually the only kind of gift that occurs in graves of this period. So it's possible that these were thrown into the well with the babies or with a baby as a kind of informal parting gift, grave gift to the baby. But there is one thing that definitely has something to do with the baby, and that's this. This is an ancient baby feeder. A little tube, you fill it with whatever you're going to feed to the baby, and the baby sucks it out of the tube. These are very rare. Only two of these from the Hellenistic period have ever been found in the excavations, and I can tell you from personal experience that there are millions of fragments of pottery of that period. So only two have ever been found, and they usually are found in burials and in burials with babies. So I think that there's no question but that this was placed in the well as a gift for one of the deceased individuals, and I think most likely probably one of the two older children, the children that were between the ages of 6 and 18 months. This would be for a child who had been weaned because it's not being fed on mother's milk anymore, and there seems to be some evidence that you didn't give grave gifts to very, very, very young infants. So my hypothesis is that this went in with one of the older children. Finally, an oddity of the pottery, the one thing that's, aside from the feeder, that stands out is a huge number of basins, big coarse basins like this. More of them than has been found in any other deposit. Now, this was an all-purpose shape. It was used for washing dishes, doing the laundry, preparing food, for industrial processes. But I speculate that some of these may have been the containers in which people placed the babies when they brought them to the well. I wouldn't think most people would simply want to walk through the streets of Athens with a deceased baby in their hands. I would have thought that they would want to carry it in some container, perhaps wrap it nicely in some piece of cloth or something like that. So they may have been for that purpose. And they're also the sort of things that you would need at the birth because you need a basin to deal with washing a baby. So they would have been convenient if midwife was dealing with a stillbirth that, as a container for the child to bring it to its final resting place. Well, now you've seen what was in this well. Let me try to give you some idea of what it might all mean. And I have three hypotheses to lay before you. There's no real solution to the mystery. Like much archaeology, we don't have the ultimate answer that we can be certain of, but I will go through three hypotheses and suggest the one that I think is most likely. Now, this is a photograph of part of the article that Larry Angel wrote, and you can see there his photograph of all the little shoulder blades that he had used for counting the babies. Now, the original excavators thought that, the original excavators thought that whatever this was, it was some extraordinary event, some catastrophic thing. And in fact, the original notion was, well, you know, couldn't possibly be baby sacrifice. The Greeks wouldn't do that, but maybe it's some sort of symbolic baby sacrifice, might have something to do with Phoenicians. So rather sensational solutions were proposed. When they kind of calmed down from that kind of thinking, they said, well, look, this must represent a time of special stress on the community. Some kind of special stress that caused the deaths of so many babies. Could it have been a siege? Because when you have a siege of a city, there is a shortage of food, and the stress would be felt by the weakest members of the community, newborn babies. And that was what, as you can see, that is what Angel proposed. It's assumed that Hellenistic infants could have produced them in a short period of time. Their deaths may have resulted from starvation because of the siege. And there was a convenient siege of Athens that was well known from literary sources. The Roman general Sulla attacked the city in March of 86 BC, and we are told that during the siege there was a famine. People were supposed to have lived on shoe leather. So you could imagine there would be heightened infant mortality and no food to feed the dogs, who would all die of starvation. Now, I think if I were there, I would have eaten the dogs. But there are no butchering marks on these dogs, so these dogs never served as human food. But in any event, we now know that that date is too early, because at the time that Angel was working in the 40s, they didn't know very much about the date of Athenian Hellenistic pottery. So it can't have anything to do with the Roman siege of 86. And the military history of Athens is pretty well known. There is no recorded catastrophic event in the period under consideration. It's of course possible that many events were unrecorded, and there's some kind of unrecorded crisis, but we have no evidence of a crisis to explain the deaths of the babies. So a second possibility, and this is the one that Dorothy Thompson was interested in. She apparently used to, she was my professor at the in graduate school, so I heard a lot from her about her ideas about this deposit, and she would go around cocktail parties and she'd buttonhole doctors and ask them, was there a disease that would kill both dogs and babies? And she never got any joy out of that question. Nobody could come up with a possible disease to explain it. But that was one possibility. Was there some unrecorded plague of some kind that might have affected the babies? Now, I got excited when I saw this advertisement for a book, a recent publication on the eradication of echinococcus in Cyprus. But I read up on it a bit and discovered that although the dogs pass the parasite to the babies, that it remains dormant until adulthood. So that wasn't going to explain this situation. More problematic than that is that in a plague, we should have victims of various ages. Now, it's true that the babies might have been the most susceptible, but surely other people died as well. So the fact that we have such a rigorously uniform group of bones, with a few outliers, a few adults, it's one adult, one older child, it's true, suggests that a plague is not the best solution. Now, our hypothesis that we and our team are developing is the alternative to the catastrophe theory, and that is that this represents normal burial practices for Athenians in the second century when they dealt with newborn children. The uniqueness of our deposit may be an illusion. You see here a model of Athens. You can see the Acropolis in the center up to the left and above it. You see the Agora area, and then lots of houses that have been put in just to indicate that the rest of the area was filled with habitations. We have excavated virtually none of that habitation area, which must be full of wells and pits and houses, and there may be other deposits like this. So we are considering the possibility that this well simply reflects the normal behavior of the ancient Athenians at the time. Now, it's very difficult to gauge the meaning of this large number of dead infants. When you think of 450, it seems like such a high number. But we don't know what the population of Athens was at this time, and there's no data that can really give us a very good estimate. And we don't know how long it took for the bones to be deposited, whether it was 5 years or 20 years. So it's hard to understand what the number 450 means. But Lisa Little looking at mortality statistics for newborn children in non-industrial societies has estimated that if the population were 30,000, which is not an unreasonable guess for Athens, and the birth rate were 4%, and the neonatal rate of mortality was 8%, the population would produce 450 dead babies in just under 5 years. So if you have a large enough population, this number of dead newborn children is simply the fact of life in a pre-industrial society when infant mortality was very, very high. So you don't need to invoke a catastrophe to explain this large number of newborn babies. Now, interestingly enough, at one point in research, I suggested to Lisa and to Lynn that they go and look at at bones from another deposit, a well that was located in this, about in the, more or less smack in the middle, just to the right of the train here, in the Agra excavations. And you can see the temple up on the hill and the brow of the hill where the bone well is located. And they pulled out the bones from this other well that's right within the Agra area, and they found two babies. Nobody had ever looked at the bones from that well. So this is not unique. There are babies in wells in Greece. Two is a lot less, of course, than 450. But since that time, I've come across a number of other deposits further away in time and place. Some newborn babies have been found in a well in Eretria on the island of Euboea. So there is some evidence that this was a normal place to discard or to inter very, very young children. Now, what do we know about how the Greeks of this period viewed young children and how they dealt with their deaths? Well, normally, babies were buried. They were never cremated, but they were buried outside the city, and sometimes they were placed in pots like this amphora that held the bones of a newborn, or at least a very young child. And there were even cemeteries specially for children. And these have been excavated and dug in Athens for the 5th and the 4th centuries. But for the Hellenistic period that I'm talking about, the 3rd and the 2nd centuries, such cemeteries have not been found. So it may be that there was a difference in burial customs, that people did not give formal burial to newborn children anymore in the Hellenistic period in the way that they had earlier on. But we still have to ask why these babies would be discarded in this not so out of the way place instead of being properly buried. And to understand that, we have to think about the Greek attitude towards small children. And this is why classical archaeologists have to be both classicists and archaeologists. We have to look at the written sources that can tell us something about the ideas of the people we are studying. This is a grave stele that shows a woman depicted with her grandchild and clearly a very warm relationship between the two figures. But we know from our ancient texts that a child was not really considered to be a human being and a member of the family until about a week after the child was born. So the question of when does life begin for an ancient Athenian would be about 10 days after birth, a week or 10 days after birth. A child entered Greek society not by virtue of being born, but by being officially and publicly accepted by the male head of the household. And there was a ceremony called the amphidromia, which literally means the runaround, in which the baby was carried around the household hearth by the head of the family. And this ceremony had binding force in law. There are speeches in law courts that say, I should have my inheritance because I was picked up and carried around the hearth by my father at the amphidromia. And at that point, or maybe a couple of days later, the child was given a name. And it seems very likely that babies who died before that ceremony, for whatever reason, would simply not be considered as human beings. They wouldn't be thought of as requiring a formal burial activity. It's also true that up until that time, the Greek father had the right to decide not to rear the child, and we would call that infanticide, but to the ancient Greeks, it seems to have looked somewhat different. Now, no one doubts that the ancient Greeks practiced infanticide, since every known society does and has practiced it. But we have no way of knowing how common it was. Some people say 2% of the births, some people say 10%, and none of those guesses are based on much of anything. But we do know that it sometimes happens. Why would people do such a thing? The usual reasons, illegitimate births, economic considerations. But there was another reason among the Greeks, and that is that it was considered irresponsible to raise a child who was not considered to be viable. This was part of responsible parenting. And there were tests applied by midwives to decide whether a child was viable or not. We don't have any information from this period, from the second century BC, but four centuries later, the writer Serenus, who was a gynecological medical writer, made a checklist for what the midwife is supposed to look at in the new baby. And if the baby passes these tests, the baby should be reared. And if not, the baby should not be. This was the sound medical advice of Serenus. And the tests were, is the mother healthy? Is the baby full term? Does the baby cry vigorously? Does it respond to stimuli appropriately? Is it the right size and shape? Is it perfect in all its parts? Are its ducts free from obstruction? Are all its natural functions strong? And do the joints bend and stretch? So if a child didn't meet those pass that test, the child would be what the Greeks call exposed, although we don't really know what that means. It may be that simply they would not nurture the child and the child would be allowed to die. A slightly dicier issue, which we can't solve and our material can't help us with, is the question of selective infanticide of females that we hear so much about in the modern world. There are a couple of literary references that are always, always, always quoted. In the first century BC, a Greek-Egyptian soldier wrote home to his wife in Egypt about the baby, if it's a boy, raise it, if it's a girl, expose it. But we don't even know if he was talking about his wife's child or the child of a slave they owned. So there's really not very much evidence about it. We had hoped that we would be able to do DNA analysis on our bones, and we might actually throw some light on that question if we knew about the sexes of these babies. It seems, however, that the metals that have preserved the bones make it very unlikely that we could extract any viable DNA for analysis from them. Measurement of the bones is not sufficient to identify the sex. I'm told by Lisa Little, there's a 50% error rate, so, you know, it's not gonna work. One thing that I have not mentioned is what we make of the adult and the 11-year-old child. And we think probably that these were outcasts of some sort. The adult had he wasn't a very old man, he was in his 20s, but he had very severe arthritis and was probably in considerable pain and may have been seen as a peculiar individual who may have been very antisocial. It's also possible that some of these people were slaves. We know that the police force of Athens wasn't really a police force. There were some public slaves underneath in charge of an official, and one of his jobs was to send out the slaves every morning to pick up the dead bodies from the streets. There were homeless people in ancient Athens, just as there are in modern cities, and sometimes they died and they had no families. Nobody came and claimed them. And these public slaves had to deal with them. And I can imagine the public slaves saying, I don't want to haul this corpse. Let's take it to the well up there, the place where the midwives take the babies. So we conjecture that that may be the source of the two adults. Obviously, they are unusual instances, although there are a few instances throughout the history of the Agora of anomalous adult burials like this. This still leaves us with the dogs to be considered. Another grave stele showing two men and faithful hound. Of course, dogs were kept by the Greeks as hunting dogs and as watchdogs, and sometimes they even gave their pets burials. The Agora has unearthed two dog burials, and one, the dog was buried with a nice bone, and the other one was buried with one of those little gray perfume flasks. They did not eat dogs, although there's no indication of butchering on the dogs. But we do know that dogs were sometimes used in sacrifices, and they were supposed to be particularly efficacious in sacrifices of purification, especially, some ancient sources say, in connection with childbirth. Now, all kinds of things that you did in the ancient world could cause pollution, and that meant some sort of bad thing was going to happen, and certain rituals had to be carried out to prevent that. And the two most polluting events were birth and death. So if we are dealing with stillborn children or children who died shortly after their birth, or children who were allowed to die in any case, we're dealing with both of these polluting events. And we have wondered whether the dogs might have been sacrificed. They would have been dogs simply picked up on the street, street curs, who could fulfill this purpose, and then they could be sacrificed and thrown into the well as a ritual. Dog burials do occur with some frequency in human cemeteries, and it has been suggested that those could also be purification sacrifices in connection with deaths. But that's at least our conjecture, and it does fit in with the somewhat unusual demography of our dogs. Instead of having a normal die-off profile of a lot of young and old dogs and not many dogs in the prime of life, we have an even spread in age of the dogs, which suggests to the zooarchaeologists that there are some other factors at work here and these aren't just natural deaths. Well, I don't want to end on a sad note. It's a bit of a sad story with all of these babies who didn't make it. But you know, a certain number of babies did survive, even with the very high infant mortality of the ancient world. And they went through their amphidromia, they received their names. And then when they were 3 years old, they participated in their first public festival, the so-called Anthesteria, the Festival of Flowers. And at that festival, children received gifts and toys and pets, and their antics are often portrayed on special little jugs that were made for the occasion, and you see one here. So this one shows us that some lucky little boy, when he was 3 years old, got a puppy, and we have the happy pair of the boy and his dog, so not all babies and dogs came to grief. Thank you. Thank you.
As usual, the speaker will take questions. There's actually a dog in the front here.
Oh.
Seems to be
a Don't tell him about this. It might upset him. Yeah.
I just wonder what they use for drinking water.
What did they use for drinking water?
The well cannot have been in use when this happened, and the houses around this area seem to have gone out of use. So they weren't using this as a water source. The people had moved out of this neighborhood, and that's why the neighborhood, this well could be used this way. It had to be a derelict neighborhood. Even one dog or baby in the well would have made it completely unusable for drinking water. Yeah. Yeah, could you, the question is about the lifespan of the pottery. So how do I know it's such a short? Well, it's very hard to know how old any single piece of pottery was when it was thrown away, but there have been ethnographic studies of tableware, not in the Greek world, but in various other parts of the world, where anthropologists have gone in and asked people, okay, here's all the stuff in your cupboard. How old are the drinking cups? How old are the water jars? And so forth. And this suggests that drinking cups are very short-lived, that they tend not to last more than a year or 5 years at the most. So this kind of pottery usually gets broken and discarded pretty quickly. And what usually happens is you'll have one or two objects that are old, just like your own china cabinet. You know, you've got a few things that maybe belong to your grandparents, but most of the things are much newer. So, you know, we date this sort of on the basis of the majority of the material, which there's good reason to think is not very long-lived. Yeah.
First you and then him.
No, they dug the well. The well was dug as a water source.
And I'd just like to know how it was excavated.
Yeah, how the well is excavated. Well, you build a framework over it so you can put a crank and just as you would have a well that you were drawing water out of. The workman starts digging it at the top and pretty soon gets down further and further, and you have a very brave person who does not suffer from claustrophobia. Pardon me?
One person at a time.
And the problem is that the person has to excavate in the dark, and once you get to a certain level, in the wet, because when you get below the water table, it's wet. So it's very, very difficult and quite dangerous kind of excavation. What they usually do is collect things in which are labeled for, say, a 20 or 30 or 40 centimeter depth of the well, and keep those separate so that you can keep the material from the different depths separate, because you can't really make out a stratigraphy very well in those conditions. About a meter. If they weren't considered human beings, why would they be given perfume containers? I think in the case of the feeder that it might be for one of the older children, and the older children would certainly have been named and would have been considered human beings. I didn't have time to go into all the details, but one of those older children, the anthropologist can tell the cause of death, and it was a blow to the head. But the child did not die immediately, so it clearly wasn't a child that was uncared for. The child was cared for, and the wound partly healed, but then the child died. So I think that's the individual who received the baby feeder. For the other things, the perfume bottles, it's only a conjecture. That could just be household waste. But I also think that there may have been people who, even if the child was not a human being, they felt fondness for the child anyway, and might have just, you know, in our human sentimental way, wanted to give something. The question is whether there was thought about population control. I don't think so. Ancient cultures were much more worried about not having enough people than having too many people, because infant mortality, from all we can guess from looking at pre-industrial societies and societies that don't have advanced medicine, there's very high infant mortality. Children get all kinds of diseases, and particularly virulent diarrheas, and at the time of birth and also at weaning. So, in fact, Aristotle says most children die before they're a week old. Now, that, you know, probably that's an exaggeration, but still, there was very high infant mortality. So they were much more worried about maintaining the population. And in fact, at this period, in the Hellenistic period, there's some good evidence that the population was dropping. We have far fewer cemeteries of this period for adults as well as for children. So it looks as though that was not a concern, quite the opposite.
Due to birth in unsanitary conditions. And that's something else to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Societies that have prejudice against females, in my experience, is because the female survives childhood and the male dies in childhood much more commonly. In a third world country in West Africa when I was younger as a physician, and I was told there that young people of a marriageable age, there were four times as many females as males. And I know they had a very high mortality rate. In some bad measles epidemics, they would lose 40% of the children, and in unreached villages, studies showed that they had a mortality, an infant mortality of 480 per thousand by the age of 5.
Wow, gosh.
So if conditions were somewhat similar in Athens, it would seem to me that you need somebody to put some medical things together because of the media you're studying.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Those are very interesting suggestions. Yeah, if the mother dies, you could get a wet nurse. That would be the best solution. And of course, there were people who did that in the society, but that would be, of course, a special problem. But thank you for your other suggestions. This is all work in progress, so I'm very happy to have suggestions for avenues to explore.
It is rather amazing that in the extensive Greek literature that has been preserved, enormous amounts of books and poems and tragedies, there is no explanation of finding hundreds of children and dogs into a well. You would say that some poet or philosopher must have commented on that.
No. We
observation
have
observation was there's
sorry.
Nothing in the ancient literature about large mass deposits of the dead like this.
Well, they do talk about whether or not you should rear children. That, I mean, there's a wonderful passage, I've got it here, from Plato's Theaetetus, where Socrates is talking to another person about an argument, but they discuss the argument as though the argument is a newborn baby. And Socrates says, here, after our somewhat painful labor, is the child we have brought to birth, whatever sort of creature it may be. His birth should be followed by the ceremony of carrying him around the hearth. But we must look at our offspring from every angle to make sure we are not taken in by a lifeless phantom not worth rearing. Or do you think that any infant of yours must be reared and not exposed? Will you bear to see him put to the proof? So although they didn't talk about what happened when you were put to the proof and you didn't succeed, they did talk about the putting to the proof. I think that also the reason it's not discussed is that it was a normal thing, so there was no need to comment on it. This is what we do in the case when a child doesn't survive, and if there's an enormous infant mortality, it's an accepted thing, so it doesn't elicit discussion by the writers.
Yeah.
I don't know of any deposits this large. There's been a deposit in, it's not a Greek city-state, but in Ashkelon in Israel with a fairly large number of very young children, probably newborns. I think they had 150. That's late Roman, however. In Sparta, it is said that babies were routinely killed if they didn't seem to be strong, and that there was a particular place they deposited them. A place with just baby bones has not been found in Sparta, although a place with bones of probably criminals has been found. But I don't know of any very, very close parallels to this in other Greek cities. Nothing that's been published. But I keep coming across, you know, as I lecture and people mention things, I do keep coming across more somewhat similar instances.
Gentleman in the front row here.
I find it interesting that a location so close to the Agora would be abandoned. Is there any suggestion as to why that might have been?
Well, the question is why a place so near the Agora would be abandoned. At this period, as I said, the population seems to be declining, and we aren't sure why these particular neighborhoods are abandoned, but all of the areas around the Agora seem to be abandoned as dwelling and working places. There seems to be a shift of the population southward within the city. We don't know why, and we don't know why the population is declining, but it seems to be good evidence of a lot of abandoned houses. So I can't answer the question of why. I can just say that it's a phenomenon that we've observed.
Is there any evidence of religious ceremonies or acknowledgments and some kind of these child deaths?
Any evidence of religious acknowledgement of the children's deaths? Not from the evidence that we have. The only piece of evidence is the little baby feeder, which could have been a gift that was put in the grave. It was treating the well like a grave and putting a gift into it. But other than that, we don't have anything. That's not to say that people didn't care and people didn't do this. You know, they chose a place that was out of the way. It's actually not so far from a shrine. It may have been a place that people felt comfortable using for this purpose. Yes? I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
I was wondering what types of measures did they
Oh, you mean in antiquity? Well, they had these lists of things. They pretty much what I read you. They're all sort of looking at the child. If you poke it, does it cry? You know, when you smack it, does it yell? You know, are all its ducts free from obstruction? You can sort of imagine what they're talking about there. You know, is it piddling? You bend its arms? Do they bend properly? And of course, is there a deformity of it? Does it have a club foot? Is there a missing part? So it was things that actually might not, in all cases, be particularly meaningful for the viability of the child, but these were the tests that apparently the midwives did perform. And it eventually gets into the written record, not until the 2nd century AD, but I'm sure that the midwives, who were the ones who were really in charge of the birthing of children, knew about these tests, and they advised families on the basis of these tests. It was basically just a sort of macroscopic inspection of the baby.
Question in the front row.
You mentioned early in your presentation that this civilization was the oldest democracy in Europe. Do you know of an older democracy anywhere else in the world?
Actually, some people have thought, do I know of an older, I mentioned it was the oldest democracy in Europe, and do I know of an older one anywhere? Some people have argued that some of the early Sumerian city-states may have had democratic components within their governance. So I hedge my bets by saying the oldest in Europe. But certainly, this is the oldest one anywhere that we know about that has greater similarities to our own system, although it was obviously quite different from our own systems.
Time for one or two more questions. Yes.
And dropping out there, actually,
sorry.
So
the lady here.
Why not hear you in the ground? You know, like the normal
I'm sorry. Yeah. There's no need because they don't need to be buried in the ground. I mean, burying them in the ground is more trouble than placing them in a well. So I think it's just a matter of not regarding them as human beings who require the more laborious method of disposal. If it falls into the well when there's still water in the well, it often doesn't break because the water will break its fall. But even if it does break, it doesn't break into tiny pieces usually. It breaks into biggish pieces. And one of the groups of specialists we have on the excavation are the conservators who search through all the broken pottery and do this incredible jigsaw puzzle of putting it together. So it's a combination of sometimes good luck that things aren't broken and then a lot of hard work of looking for the pieces that join up. So we have professional experts who do that for us.
Any